streamlined design that sets it apart from the lookalike.
Business is built on data, facts, and figures. It's also made up of some of the most fascinating stories the world has known. What makes business tick? What are the stories we can find in their failures and victories? Get ready to find out what some of today's leaders were thinking right now on Business Disrupted. Here is your host, Ted Gavin.
Welcome to Business Disrupted. Today, we're talking about one story with many facets: the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School, conspiracy theories bandied about for entertainment, the preternaturally unhinged and how they react to equally unhinged media, the power of defamation lawsuits, the sheer absurdity of ignoring a court order to produce information, and finally, abusing the bankruptcy process. In other words, we're talking about noted internet crackpot Alex Jones and the bankruptcy he just filed for three of his companies in an attempt to get out from under the damages he will ultimately owe to those suing him for defamation. Alleged defamation. Well, no, the court actually issued a default judgment, but we'll get to that. To help us make sense of this pickle barrel full of crackpottery, we're joined again by Daniel Gill, a reporter for Bloomberg Law's bankruptcy desk, who has written extensively on these cases. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Pleased to be here, Ted, as always.
So let's lay some history here. On December 14th, 2012, Adam Lanza shot and killed 26 people, 20 of whom were children between 6 and 7 years old, and six adult staff members at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. Shortly after burying their children, many of the Sandy Hook parents came under attack from people who were repeating claims made by Alex Jones on his broadcast and on his website, that these parents made up the entire shooting in an elaborate scheme to enact stricter gun control laws.
Right, and let's stay the name of the website. It's InfoWars. It's notorious.
Yes,
everyone's heard about it.
And it is described as a conspiracy theory website.
Self-described.
Right, which is interesting because conspiracy theories are called conspiracy theories because they are rarely, if ever, true.
It seems to generally, doesn't it, connote the notion that it's crackpottery? You know, it's conspiracy theory. It means it's not real. But this guy proudly says, yes, we're a right-wing conspiracy theory website. Come hear us and to get all the real stuff.
That's right. And Alex Jones, of all of the people saying that Sandy Hook was false, he was the most vocal and the most widely publicized. On his website and on his radio program, he said that the shootings were, and these are quotes, completely fake, a giant hoax, and the fakest thing since the $3 bill, and that they were perpetrated by opponents of the Second Amendment, because apparently Alex Jones isn't able to let a national tragedy go by without making it about himself. So in mid-2018, after receiving death threats and online harassment from Alex Jones's listeners and others, several of the Sandy Hook victims' parents sued Alex Jones and the InfoWars companies for defamation of his claims.
Ted, can I break in with a fact?
Yeah.
I think it's pertinent that on his website, on InfoWars, Alex Jones called upon his listeners to investigate. Go out there and investigate these claims. Basically a call to his legions of listeners to go and harass these people.
Right. And we see how that worked with Pizzagate when somebody showed up at a pizza place in Washington, D.C. with a rifle and was surprised to find that there wasn't a basement full of enslaved children. So the Sandy Hook victims' parents are suing Alex Jones and the InfoWars companies for defamation because of his statements. Not surprisingly, these aren't the only lawsuits Mr. Jones is facing. He also misidentified the shooter at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, and he publicized the name of somebody who was entirely innocent of any involvement in the massacre. But Jones decided he was the guilty party because the man happened to be wearing what Jones characterized as communist garb. I don't know what communist garb is. I assume it involves burlap, but but that's what he did. So 4 years, this litigation has gone by. And during the litigation, Alex Jones has consistently ignored discovery demands from the plaintiffs. You know, when you're in a lawsuit, each party is allowed to ask the other side for information relating to the facts of the case. And the court will order you to turn it over if you don't turn it over voluntarily. And Alex Jones was under court order and he ignored them. He ignored court-issued subpoenas to sit for deposition. He's been fined hundreds of thousands of dollars in sanctions by the courts in which this litigation is taking place. And as a result of his abuse of the litigation process, the courts issued default judgments against Jones and InfoWars. So the trials are not going to happen as to the fact of defamation. He is now guilty of defamation. The trials are now going to be for damages, how much he's going to have to pay for having been found guilty.
The lawyers like to say that the judgment is for liability. It found that InfoWars and Alex Jones are liable for all the things that the Sandy Hook family said they're liable for.
That's right. And so now the trials that were about to start in April were to set, to determine the amount of the damages. What are the costs of what he did? So it's worth noting that in one of the lawsuits in which Jones did actually sit for a deposition, he testified under oath that in his defense, a form of psychosis, and those are his words, a form of psychosis made him believe that the Sandy Hook massacre was staged. He said that as a result of the media and corporations lying to people, he began to believe that everything was a lie. He actually described it as though he was a parent to a child who lied serially, and so he just stopped believing everything, which is an unusual parenting style, but we'll get to that. As a pundit, he said his psychosis made him think lots of things were staged, but he said that his accusations against the Sandy Hook victims' parents were never made consciously to hurt them. So not only was Jones coached badly on how to avoid being found responsible for defamation, but we can all thank our personal deities that we're not Alex Jones's child. Personally, I think Jones lowballed it. I think some form of psychosis is responsible for far more of his behavior than just calling the Sandy Hook massacre fake, but that's beyond the scope of today's discussion.
Well, and frankly, at this point, it's relevant to people who are outraged by the man, but it's not relevant to what's going on in the litigation because the court has determined that he's liable and excuses don't matter. Now it's just a question of how much does he owe? How much were these families hurt? And not just the families. There's also one first responder, one of the first responders who was there on that day in Newtown, Connecticut, is one of the plaintiffs as well.
Right. Well, and so defamation, if we're going to go really down the legal rabbit hole, defamation is a tort, and torts, you prove elements of the thing to determine whether the defendant is guilty or not, except in rare circumstances involving notable public figures, intending to harm the party isn't necessarily an element of defamation. So whether or not he intended consciously to cause harm by what he was saying doesn't change the fact that his statements were defamatory and a court found them that. On the eve of the damages trial, Jones offered to settle the claims against him and his companies for about $120,000 for each plaintiff. And unsurprisingly, that offer was summarily rejected by the plaintiffs. And it's pretty easy to understand why. In the last year, Jones's companies made more than $56 million in distributions of cash to Alex Jones himself and to several other companies owned or controlled by Jones, his family, or close associates.
And so Ted, where do we get that figure from?
That figure is from court filings. So remember. So
that's what he's admitted to.
Right. That's what he's admitted to.
Who knows what he got that he didn't admit to?
Well, it's entirely possible, and I'm sure that will be the focus of any investigation. But all those payments would be recoverable in litigation under state law brought by creditors like the defamation plaintiffs or in a bankruptcy case of the entity that made the transfers. So when the litigation plaintiffs rejected that offer, Alex Jones caused three of his companies called InfoW LLC, Prison Planet LLC, and IW Health LLC to file for bankruptcy protection under Chapter 11 in the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Southern District of Texas. And they filed under what is called the Small Business Reorganization Act, or the SBRA. And that's using the newly established subchapter 5 of Chapter 11. This type of case is for debtors with limited debt, small businesses, and it offers the debtor a number of advantages and controls over the case that don't exist outside of the SBRA in a regular Chapter 11 case. So the debtor's plan, such as it is to funnel all of the defamation claims to a trust that will be overseen by two retired judges who I cannot believe were willing to associate themselves with Alex Jones. And that trust will be funded over several years with payments from Jones and from other Jones entities. Basically, this is an exercise to stiff the defamation plaintiffs. So in some cases, using bankruptcy to screw creditors is perfectly permissible. Danny, is this one of those cases?
Well, obviously, you're going to hear from the plaintiffs, the Sandy Hook plaintiffs, and we have heard from them, that it's not permissible. It's not a permissible use. Look, let's face it. You couched the when you said the question, you couched it in terms of you know, screw the claimants, you know, by filing bankruptcy. That's unfair in the bankruptcy world at large. People don't necessarily file bankruptcy just to, you know, get out of having to pay their creditors. They file it so that they can reorganize and continue to exist and continue to contribute to the economy and pay their employees and pay back at least some of their debts.
Right.
But here, there have been two motions to dismiss that were filed for plaintiffs in Connecticut and plaintiffs in Texas saying this is a bad faith bankruptcy filing
and should be dismissed. And a third motion to dismiss filed by the United States trustee, which is the Department of Justice watchdog over the sanctity of the bankruptcy system.
I missed that the U.S. trustee filed a motion to dismiss. So thanks for telling me that. I do know that they weighed in early hearings to question the propriety of the bankruptcies, especially as a subchapter 5 case, because subchapter 5 is supposed to be for small businesses. And what's a small business? The bankruptcy code defines it. It's a company that is, and I don't have it in front of me, so forgive me, but it basically is a company that's actively engaged in commerce or business.
Right.
And these three companies that filed aren't. InfoWars, which didn't file, is the one that runs the website. I'm sorry, not InfoWars. It's called
Free Speech Systems.
Thank you. Free Speech Systems LLC. Thank you for covering me there, Ted. I appreciate it. And Alex Jones himself. And they did not file.
Well, and interestingly, so there are a number of ways in which these debtors' reality and subchapter 5 diverge. So as Danny, you mentioned, SBRA cases, the small business cases, the subchapter 5 cases are designed for operating small business debtors. They're also designed for debtors with debt amounting to no more than $2.75 million, with an increase that went into effect after April 30th. It's now just over $3 million. But these debtors are representing to the court that they have a genuine belief that their total debts will not exceed $3 million. Knowing how hard it is to get a defamation case to the point where you've actually won it, and the degree to which there is evidence as to what happened as a result of Alex Jones's statements, is there any chance that these litigation claims would legitimately be less than $3 million? I don't see it.
How can it be? You see tort awards for tens or 20s or even hundreds of millions of dollars for things that are far less just heinous.
I mean, the legal fees alone for the plaintiffs, just caused by Jones's intransigence in the discovery process, will be more than $3 million.
I'm sure that's right. I don't know for a fact, but it's easy to imagine that it's going to be well above that. And these lawyers have basically been working for free for all these years because, you know, they don't want to take the money from these poor families until there's a victory.
Right. And so one of the other issues is, as you mentioned, the SBRA is designed for operating companies. These are not operating companies. These companies hold intellectual property. They hold the intellectual property to some of the medications, if we're going to call them that, I guess supplements that Alex Jones sells on his programs and on his website. They hold the the intellectual property, the names, the InfoWars name that Alex Jones uses. And that's pretty much about it. So the debtors have claimed that that they are eligible because being a holding company is a legitimate business, and that there are agreements in place between the non-debtors, the companies that haven't filed bankruptcy, and the three companies in bankruptcy. But they also admit that these agreements were all cobbled together as the company rushed into bankruptcy.
Ted, I'm not familiar entirely with your audience. Is it worth backing up a little bit to talk about why the operating company and Alex Jones didn't file bankruptcy?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that for people to understand, why would they do that? Well, they did that because the filing of the bankruptcy enacted an automatic stay that happens whenever a bankruptcy is filed that freezes all litigation and collection activities against the debtor. Now, these debtors, I believe, were also named defendants in the lawsuits. And so the lawyers went to the Connecticut judge who was getting ready to try the damages and the Texas judge who was ready to try the damages and said, hold everything. We got a bankruptcy. You can't do anything right now. And those judges put it on hold. But Alex Jones didn't file. And remind me of the name of the company again, Ted.
And Free Speech Systems.
Free Speech Systems. That didn't file. And there's a real reason they didn't file, because they have assets.
Right.
And when you file bankruptcy, your assets become subject to the jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court. Your assets become what's called the bankruptcy estate. And you have fiduciary duties regarding that property of the estate to all the creditors that you don't have without it. Go ahead.
And more importantly, your assets become available to creditors.
Exactly.
And if you happen to be Alex Jones and you lose control of Free Speech Systems because, for example, the court decides after all of your protracted discovery violations, you're not capable of being trusted to run your company for the benefit of the estate, for the benefit of creditors, then the court's going to put a trustee in. And the trustee will propose a plan that uses those assets in a way that you probably don't like. But
trustees across America will be licking their chops to get a hold of a case like this.
Oh, absolutely. So this raises an interesting question. Why not just go to the Connecticut and Texas court and say, the automatic stay applies to the companies that have no assets. That's fine. We'll stay that litigation. But Your Honor, let us proceed against the non-debtors.
Well, that might happen still. That might happen still. The plaintiffs certainly might. Right now, the plaintiffs have filed motions to dismiss. That's their strategy. We want to end these bankruptcies now. But if the judge decides that I'm going to let the bankruptcy stay, then I would suspect that these plaintiffs will file a motion for relief from the automatic stay so that they will be allowed to continue their lawsuit against the companies that aren't in bankruptcy. And the companies that are in bankruptcy, they won't touch because they're not allowed to. They're protected by the bankruptcy. But let's find out how much Jones and Free Speech owes us.
Well, and a lot of the justification that Jones's lawyers are putting forward as a rational basis, a good faith basis for these companies being in bankruptcy, is largely circular. So they talk about how Alex Jones hasn't filed bankruptcy because that would somehow hurt the value of his intellectual property, would hurt the value of his brand. But at the same time, his brand is owned by the debtor, and he's going to pay some paltry sum of money to one of the debtors to try and escape from these claims. So let's look back again at the SBRA eligibility issue. So the first dispute is whether these entities that simply own intellectual property, but they don't employ anybody, they don't do anything other than license that intellectual property to Free Speech Systems and Alex Jones, can they be debtors? So the debtors filed in Victoria, Texas, not really a bankruptcy hotbed, but they filed there because of the judge who's there. And that judge in July of 2021 wrote an order in a case that the debtors think supports the notion that these holding company debtors can be SBRA debtors. We'll see how this judge feels about being quoted to himself. Usually judges are not big fans of that, particularly in a very complicated case. So
they don't want to be embarrassed. They don't want to have to reverse themselves or rule inconsistently.
Well, that's right. And so there's a lot happening on the bench in the Southern District of Texas right now. They've had for a few cases to be designated judges. And one of those judges is rolling off of that panel. Yeah.
I lost you there for a few seconds. I think that might be on your side. So you want to repeat what you just said?
Sure. So this has ramifications for how Texas handles bankruptcy cases as well. You know, they have this two-judge panel that handles complex Chapter 11 cases. One of the judges is rolling off. The judge in the InfoWars case is widely perceived as one of the judges who will replace him, which means he'll be doing a lot of Chapter 11 cases. One of the things that parties in a complex Chapter 11 case strive for is consistency. And so if you have a decision that is inexplicable in a case like this, that could have real ramifications for the Southern District of Texas as a bankruptcy venue and for parties' willingness to fund cases there if they don't know what's going to happen.
It's called precedent.
Well, yeah.
And where you file makes a difference, especially in bankruptcy with 96 judicial districts around the country, or 94. My memory is not what it used to be.
It's a lot.
And there's a huge variety of decisions that are going to come down. But as you said, you know, the Southern District of Texas is a pretty hot district these last several years for filing major bankruptcies. Of course, by definition, a subchapter 5 case is not a major bankruptcy. It can't be. It's a small, fast bankruptcy for someone with debts that aren't more than $3 million.
Right.
By the way, there is legislation pending right now that would move the debt limit up to $7.5 million for a couple of years.
Yeah. And the CARES Act did that, but it sunsetted earlier this year.
Right. On March 29, it ended, but in March 2020, under the CARES Act, Congress bumped the limit up to $7.5 million. Now, every bankruptcy professional I've ever talked to, especially those that were involved with pushing for the Small Business Restructuring Act, they all say that the $3 million isn't enough. I mean, that's right. Nothing. You got to have, they want 10 or 12, but they're happy to have 7.5.
Yeah, there is a move in place to try and raise the SBRA number well above $7.5 million, up to much more than that.
Right. But right now the bill that's in front of that's in Congress would raise it to $7.5 million for 2 years. The Senate passed it unanimously, and we're all waiting to see what the House is going to do.
And so let's talk for a moment about why an SBRA case is so attractive to the party that owns the company. You know, normally in bankruptcy, there is a priority. And if creditors aren't paid in full, then the equity holders can't keep their equity in the company. You lose the company. And the SBRA was designed to address that because too many small businesses weren't filing bankruptcy because they were afraid of losing the business. And that just actually made the distress worse.
That's right.
What does the SBRA do to address that?
Well, the SBRA basically changes the law. In a regular Chapter 11, there's something called the absolute priority rule. And what that rule says is that no class of creditors can get paid if a senior class of creditors isn't paid in full first, or at least doesn't agree to accept a figure. So if all the unsecured creditors aren't paid in full, then there's nothing for equity. And equity, of course, is owning the company. And if people don't want to risk losing their entire companies by filing a bankruptcy. But there's also many other benefits for a subchapter 5 besides the absolute priority rule. I think, and I could be wrong, just my opinion, but I think the main positive to the Small Business Restructuring Act is that it's just a lot cheaper and easier than a Chapter 11. A regular Chapter 11 is prohibitively expensive. It's hard to imagine anybody filing, any law firm agreeing to file a Chapter 11 case without taking a $100,000 retainer at least.
Right.
You know? And the big cases, that's gone before you turn off the lights of the first night of looking at the case.
But in this case, one of the things that is attractive to Alex Jones is that the SBRA makes it easier for a debtor to cram a plan down on dissenting creditors. And here we have no creditors who aren't dissenting.
Well, we don't know yet. I mean, I'm sure he'll come up with some convenience classes of creditors that are owed money for just, you know, vendors or services, or, you know, utilities, whatever, who are going to be able to agree to take something, even if they might even agree to take a little bit less, maybe employees, who knows? Although these companies don't have employees, so we're back in that circle. I lost our place. Where are we?
And so we're talking about the benefits of SBRA over a regular Chapter 11.
Right. Other benefits include there's no creditors committee appointed.
So you have no adverse party overseeing the bankruptcy case.
You know, or at least you're not having to pay the adverse party, you know, from your own pot,
right.
which in major Chapter 11s is the case. I mean, if you fought a big Chapter 11 case, they have to pay for the bankruptcy estate's going to pay for the bankruptcy lawyers for the debtor, but also for the bankruptcy lawyers for the creditors, you know, and it's that's a big expense. It's also faster. You have to propose a plan in 90 days and just, you got to get it done. And that makes everything cheaper and easier and smoother. A trustee is appointed, but a trustee doesn't necessarily take over the business unless, you know, the court orders it.
Right.
And the trustee doesn't have to take over the business.
Well, and the trustee is incentivized to help the debtor along. That's the whole purpose. They almost act as a neutral to help the debtor through this process.
I talked to a woman in Washington who's a regular Chapter Sub 5 trustee, and she says one of the most rewarding things about the job is just talking with these mom and pop businesses and just teaching them about, you know, fiscal responsibility and basic accounting principles that you have to follow.
We're talking with Daniel Gill of Bloomberg Lug Bankruptcy. If you have questions, tweet them to us at BIZDisrupted or email them to comments@disrupted.business. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back right after some messages.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Gavin Solmanese is the experienced leader for complex financial matters, restructuring, and litigation consulting. Whatever your situation, we have the ability and know-how to restore troubled companies to profitability and growth. We've successfully completed financial advisory engagements for hundreds of companies that have gone on to renewed health and success. No matter the size or complexity of the case, our clients always work directly with senior professionals and receive exceptional work product. We know that asking the right questions is always the first step in defining the true problem. Generating alternative solutions and finding a clear path forward is what we do. To us, it's all about results. What you do next is what counts. When there are tough decisions and hard choices to make, you need smart, strategic people beside you. Choose the team who never stops working until your problem, dispute, or financial crisis is resolved. Visit Gavin Solmanese at GavinSolmanese.com or call us at 302-655-8997.
Voice America programs are now available on your favorite connected device, including Amazon, Alexa, and Google Home. Through streams with Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio, listening to your favorite show is as easy as saying the show name followed by the word podcast.
Hey, Alexa, play Finding Your Frequency podcast.
If that doesn't work, try adding on TuneIn or on iHeartRadio or on Apple Podcasts.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Business Disrupted. To reach our program today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to contact@disrupted.business. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. If you have questions, tweet them to us at BIZ Disrupted or email them to comments@disrupted.business. We're talking with Danny Gill of Bloomberg Law Bankruptcy about the InfoWars bankruptcy and just how much an abuse of the bankruptcy system these cases are. And so far, I think we've agreed they're pretty much very much an abuse of the bankruptcy system. So, Danny, let's talk a little bit about kind of the structure here. You've got Free Speech Systems, which is the operating entity. It's what puts on the radio show. It's what manages the website. It's what pays Alex Jones. And that's where all of the things happen. And that's one of the primary targets of the defamation litigation. It's one of the primary defendants. How is it that we now have these three kind of out of nowhere subsidiaries that are in bankruptcy? And the debtor's plan is to create a trust in one of them where it's going to funnel all of the claims against, but these entities don't have any money. So they're going to dump money into the trust and contain the claims, despite the fact that these plaintiffs are suing everything.
You know, I think that the lawyers who are doing this are looking at the landscape today. They're looking at cases like Purdue Pharma, or Johnson & Johnson's little subsidiary LTL Management. And, you know, in those cases, well, you know, in Johnson & Johnson, the debtor is, Johnson & Johnson created another company to file bankruptcy that its only asset is however much money Johnson & Johnson decides it's going to deposit in it to pay the creditors for massive tort claims related to allegedly asbestos tainted talc. Their famous baby powder. A lot of people are claiming they got mesothelioma or ovarian cancer from those products. More than 40,000. Right. So that's one case where you see a big company that's got a lot of money creating another company to file bankruptcy. Let's just put this company in bankruptcy and have them deal with all the liability. I think that's what the lawyer, and I'm not in their head, but I think that's what those lawyers who are representing Alex Jones are thinking.
So let me put my law student hat on and let's talk about the ways in which this is different from that. So first, the cases where this type of thing is happening are mass tort cases. And this is not a mass tort case. This is not 40,000 people. This is a handful of people.
It's a maximum of 27 families.
Right. And so another way in which it's different is there is a loophole in Texas law that allows a company to create a subsidiary and then stuff liabilities of a common type into that entity. It's called the Texas two-step. And that's the means by which Johnson & Johnson formed LTL and stuffed liabilities and $1 billion into that. But these aren't new companies. These were existing companies, and these claims have nothing to do with the normal business purpose of these companies. So that's different.
It doesn't really make a lot of sense. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Why put these non-operating companies in bankruptcy just so you can protect Alex Jones and free speech? Mm-hmm. Because those companies are still going to be a target.
Right.
Somehow, come hook or by crook, they're going to be a target unless they're able, you know, Jones's companies are able to convince the judge that he should issue a protective order to prevent any litigation against Alex Jones or free speech. That they might be thinking that because that's what happened in Purdue Pharma.
Right.
There's all these claims against Purdue Pharma, the manufacturer of OxyContin, and against the owners, the Sacklers family. There were two families named Sacklers that came down. We could go on and on about that. So that's a big divergence. But the point is that the courts issued an injunction saying no one who's suing for opioid abuse can sue the Sacklers because of this bankruptcy. And that's controversial. So that's probably what Jones wants too. It's like, you can't sue me because these other companies fought.
Well, and it's called a channeling injunction. It's a court order saying that any claims that you want to bring against these other parties, you have to bring against this and this bankrupt entity. And that arose out of the asbestos cases. And it's well-developed law. It's being tested now in other cases. And the opioid cases are one. The Boy Scouts of America case is another.
Sex abuse cases.
The sex abuse cases are very popular for this. But there's a common element in all of those cases, which is that the claims are legitimately against the debtor that's filed. It's the debtor that would have been sued in the first place, or was being sued in the first place.
Well,
and it's the other entities that are putting money into the debtor. That's not necessarily happening here in any substantive form.
Well, I don't know if I'm going to agree with you on that, Ted, because a lot of companies used the Texas two-step to create another debtor that will house the asbestos liability for all these different companies that over the last 10, 20 years have been using the bankruptcy and the channeling injunction to deal with mass torts and through this channeling injunction. So they actually did create other companies, and all they put into the companies is an agreed amount of money that the courts are going to decide. But right. I think what an interesting difference between those kind of cases is future claims. When you have mass torts, especially in asbestos contamination, it's impossible to know what your creditor base is going to be, what your tort claimants are going to be, because some people aren't going to exhibit any illnesses for another 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
Right.
So that's why Congress created this channeling injunction so that all the money would go into one pot, and that money would be used to pay the current claimants and future claimants. And there's a lot of negotiation and fighting about how much is allotted to each. But otherwise, the poor person who's going to get sick next year isn't going to have any recourse, where the person who's already sick might get paid in full.
Right. So, and that's one of the reasons why you have asbestos bankruptcies that are still going and still open after 20 something years, because they have to stay open for the life of the potential liability.
Exactly. And the channeling injunctions is the way that they do that. And it's controversial whether you can use a channeling injunction in other kind of matters. But that's what we're going to see.
Right. But even in all of those cases, if you look at Texas two-step cases, the reason why they stuff the liabilities into a subsidiary is because the parent would be sued otherwise. The reason why the Boy Scouts are using a channeling injunction is because the Boy Scouts of America, the parent entity, was already being sued. And so the local councils and the insurance companies are contributing money to the entity that's being sued, so they themselves are not later sued. The reason why the Sacklers are putting in $6 billion into Purdue Pharma is because Purdue Pharma was getting sued, and they want to make sure that the Sackler family can't get sued. So you've got the entity against which there are properly claims who is getting the benefit of this infusion of value from another entity. Here, the claims were never properly only against these entities. There are other entities out there against whom the claims are lodged. And the amount of money isn't really necessary to these entities, because the other entities have funds to satisfy these claims.
You mean the non-filing entities?
The non-filing bankrupt entities.
Specifically Free Speech and Alex Jones himself.
That's right.
They've got assets. They are debtors to these creditors.
Right.
That's been established.
So the bankrupt companies are not benefiting from the infusion of cash from the parties that are hoping to get the release, because the claims were never against them in the first place. So their structure is, hey, let's wreck these companies by putting all the claims against them, and then we'll get a release by contributing money to pay some of the claims.
Right. Well, I mean, Alex Jones is hoping that he can put $2 million into these bankruptcy estates in order to pay the, you know, the creditors. Instead, right. And he wants the bankruptcy court to decide how much she owes, instead of the judges who have been presiding over his trials and have been very frustrated with his refusal to obey court orders over years. I mean, let's remember that you mentioned this before. The judges issued a default judgments against him as a punishment for not complying with court orders. You know, that happens. Usually a judge might order you to produce discovery, and if you don't do it, the judge will say, well, I'm going to charge you $1,000 a day until you comply.
Right.
But then if you still don't comply, what do? And if you ignore the court and you disobey orders over and over, the court has the power to use terminating sanctions, to kill your side of the case by a sanction. And that's what happened. So the right. liability is there.
Well, and that's usually what happens, not only for not complying with discovery orders, but generally withholding evidence. If you withhold evidence, you don't get to use it at trial. Here, they basically withheld all of their evidence, which right. in effect means they have nothing to put on at trial. So, Danny, where does this go? We've got these motions to dismiss, and they're all up and going to be heard together at the end of this month, the end of May. What do you think happens between now and then?
Well, if I had the crystal ball, I'm going to think that these cases are going to be dismissed, or Jones and Free Speech are going to also file. I think if they file, the cases will not be dismissed.
Right, but they won't be SBRA cases.
They can't be SBRA cases. They'd be a regular Chapter 11 case, and I also wouldn't be surprised if the Sandy Hook families came back and said, okay, let's get a trustee appointed to take over these assets because Alex Jones has proved he can't be trusted to take care as a fiduciary for all of us. He's already shown he's not going to do that. So, they're going to ask the judge to let the Connecticut court and the Texas court go ahead with their trials and decide what amounts are owed. It can do that while the bankruptcy is still pending. and then the debtors in the bankruptcy say, well, okay, this is what the claims are. The Texas and Connecticut said, this is what we owe. This is how we propose paying them. And they propound a Chapter 11 plan.
Right. Well, so an SBRA case, the debtor has to file a plan within 120 days, right?
90 days.
So if the damages trials were to go forward on an expedited basis, would you be able to finish two damage trials, one in Connecticut state court, one in Texas state court, quickly enough to be able to have a definite amount of those claims before the debtor had to file a plan?
Hard to imagine. But I suppose it's possible. It all depends on how much evidence is going to be put on. Right. There is a limited amount of people who are hurt, you know, family members. But, you know, some of these families have lots of members. And what's happened to the little brother or the big sister of the 6-year-old girl who was murdered, you know, and then this guy goes on TV and says it was a lie. It was a hoax. They weren't murdered. You know, what does that do to the psyche of a kid?
Right.
It's going to take a long time for the court to put a dollar figure on that.
Well, and there's another aspect of it too, which is, you know, just the guy going on TV or on YouTube or on the radio or the internet and saying, I don't think this happened or this was all fake. That's one thing. But, you know, in inciting your listeners to then go and intervene in the lives of these individuals, in order to prove your own point, that's taking it a step further. And I think there is going to be every incentive for the plaintiffs to argue to the court that the court can send a message to kind of the public at large, which is this has to stop and this has to stop now because you're going to be responsible for the crazy that you spout on the pulpit.
That's right. And you know, as a hopefully sane person, You know, I'm praying that it happens, because it's conspiracy theories are dangerous, and all you have to do is look around at what's happening in our world today, in our country. The whole world. It's scary. I mean, what's happened to truth? You know, we still need courts to tell us what's true and what isn't, even if they're wrong, which happens. But that's their job. I mean, the court determines what the facts are.
So the debtors in this case have sort of forecasted out for the court in a hearing last week what their expectation for the case would be were it to go forward, and that is stay in bankruptcy, and then we're going to ask the court to appoint a mediator to bring the parties together to mediate, and then we're going to establish the amount of the litigation plaintiff's claims, and then we're going to file a plan. Do you think there is any chance that they ever reach a mediated settlement in this case?
For certainly not with enough time to get a plan filed within 90 days. But I can't, my gut, of course, says no way, no chance are you ever going to get a settlement out of this. I mean, unless all of a sudden Alex Jones comes up with real money, enough money that it's going to hurt him.
Yeah.
Enough money that's going to hurt him. I don't think the Sandy Hook families will be satisfied, with an award that's just a nuisance value. You know, well, here, take some cash, go buy yourself a boat, and forget about us. No, they want to send a message. This man has gone and hurt them in the most vulnerable place imaginable, the loss of a child. You know, they want their pound of flesh, and I can't imagine this being settled in a mediation. Also, Ted, if you're going to do a mediation, why not do a mediation in the state courts?
Well, exactly. You don't need bankruptcy court to do a mediation. You don't need any court to do a mediation.
And, right. You
know, in fact, mediation is usually your last best opportunity for people who actually understand the dispute to solve the dispute to their satisfaction. Because you put it in the hands of a judge, and you're letting someone who knows less about everything than you do decide what's going to happen to you. That can't seem like a good idea to the Alex Jones side of this engagement, objectively.
Do you think that Alex Jones is capable of being objective?
I mean, look, he is certainly invested in his position. The question is, what's the advice he's getting? And I imagine the advice he's getting is, well, let's see if it works. You're either gonna have to spend a little bit of money or a lot of money. Let's spend a little bit now and see if we can get out of paying a lot.
Right.
And that's probably, I mean, if you're purely looking at Alex Jones's financial motive, that probably makes this all make sense.
I think you're right, Ted. I think you're right, and it's easy to imagine that, you know, that's what these lawyers said. I mean, they'll say, look, at the very, very worst case scenario is we don't get away with this strategy, but it was worth a shot.
Right.
And right. I don't think they're going to find themselves being sanctioned for this attempt, because there is a case out there that said a holding company can be eligible to be a subchapter 5 debtor.
Right. That's the sanctions for that. I mean, first, having spent a lot of years teaching legal ethics to lawyers, I am consistently disappointed with how light sanctions are against lawyers. You know, they're supposed to be punitive and an incentive to not do something again. They're not supposed to be put the person...
Another cost of doing business.
Yeah, they're another cost of doing business, not a sentence to debtor's prison. But, and so even if they were sanctioned for the lawyers violating one of the bankruptcy rules on being at least reasonably informed as to the nature of their statements in court, it's not going to be much. The real penalty here is going to come from the state courts in the defamation damages.
Right.
So one of the things, and a debtor's plan is due within 90 days, but one of the things that happens in a lot of small business cases is you file a plan in 90 days that you know has no chance of getting confirmed. And that just becomes your thumbtack. You've met the statutory deadline, and that becomes an invitation to have conversations with the other parties in the case.
Right. I think it's important to remember that the bankruptcy system at large is a system. They call it a court of equity. It's a system that's designed to get parties to get together and figure out solutions, to figure out a way to make it work. And it takes creativity, but that's what judges want. Judges want parties to come together and figure out a way.
Yeah. There's an attorney at Cozen O'Connor in Chicago named Bob Fishman. He was the fee examiner for the Detroit Chapter 9 bankruptcy case several years ago. And he describes bankruptcy, particularly a municipal bankruptcy, as an invitation to negotiate. You know, nothing that happens on the first day is necessarily going to have any relation to what happens on the last day. And a lot of what happens in the middle is just trying to figure out what the next step is to get to the end. But, and I think in this case, there's probably not going to be a lot of conversation between now and the end of May between the parties. This doesn't seem to me like something where they're going to reach a deal on the courthouse steps at the end of May, the day of the hearing.
No, they're going to try to get the case dismissed. If the case isn't dismissed, they're going to ask the bankruptcy judge to give them permission to liquidate the damages in the state court.
Right. Go ahead.
I was just going to say they'll have the state court liquidate the damages, and then they'll go to the bankruptcy court to fight over who's going to pay what.
And so let's talk about who's going to pay what. $56 million have floated out of these various companies over the last year, about $18 million of it to Alex Jones himself and the rest to friends and family owned LLCs and associate controlled LLCs. Surely somebody in this process is going to say, well, Your Honor, this is all the money that we have, and it's because all of this money has gone out. So what remedy do the creditors have if they get a judgment and they come a call in to collect?
Well, that's a great point, Ted. I mean, that's the flip side of, sorry, my back. That's the flip side of bankruptcy. The creditors might actually be better off having the cases in bankruptcy, because if they can get a trustee appointed, the trustee is the one that would sue the recipients of all this money that went out in the last year and claw it back for creditors. You know, Alex Jones isn't going to have the motivation to do that, but a trustee will. A trustee is going to get to take home a piece of that.
Interesting. And so, and those remedies, how are they different between bankruptcy court and state court? Do they have remedies to pull those back in state court if that's where they're left?
Well, that's a good question. And that's a complex question that has as many answers as there are states. But the short of it is in bankruptcy court, bankruptcy courts do it all the time. I mean, that's the bread and butter. A company in bankruptcy sues to recover money that was improperly scooted away from creditors before the filing.
Right.
Let's claw that back, clawback action, long arm statutes to get that stuff back. The bankruptcy court uses state laws to do that. So the state laws also have the same fraudulent conveyance laws to recover money that's improperly transferred. The question is who's in bankruptcy now? If Alex Jones and Free Speech aren't in bankruptcy and they get a judgment against them, they're going to try to collect against those guys, and there's nothing going to stop them. Unless the court somehow miraculously issues an order saying, well, I'm not going to let you sue Alex Jones and Free Speech, even though they're not in bankruptcy. You know, they did that for Sacklers. Sacklers ponied up $6 billion. A lot of people say that's not enough. A lot of people say that's not justice. But on the other hand, a lot of people are saying, including the victims, this is money we need, and we need it now. And it's real.
Right. Well, Danny, that is all we have time for. Thank you for joining us. Just a word before we close. This is the last show of our first season. If you've been listening, thank you. If you're new to the show, welcome. We're going to take a break for a few weeks to retool and rework some of our production. We want to make a cleaner, more produced, and better edited show. So we're going to change our production process from a live show to a pre-recorded show that will allow for better and cleaner storytelling. We want your suggestions for topics and questions, and we invite them by Twitter or email. Thanks for being patient and sticking with us while we prepare for season 2. In the meantime, we're now available on every podcast platform wherever fine podcasts are given away for free. Daniel Gill is a reporter for Bloomberg Law and works the bankruptcy desk. You can find Danny Gill on Twitter at Daniel H. Gill. We'll put links to his social media and website on this episode's page on our website. Business Disrupted is hosted by me, Ted Gavin. Our executive producer is Robert Cellino. Our audio engineer is Josh Rendell. Our theme song and other original music are by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder, and our complete theme is included on Breakmaster Cylinder's new album, Songs for Broadcast Part 8, available on Bandcamp or wherever you download music legally. Branding by Peg Fitzpatrick and PMG Group, PR and social media by Emily Stern and ABNC Creative. You can find episode guides, show notes, and sign up for our newsletter at our website at disrupted.business. Email your thoughts to contact at disrupted.business or tweet them at BIZ Disrupted. You've been listening to Business Disrupted on Voice America Business and the World Talk Radio Network.
Thank you for tuning in to Business Disrupted. Be sure to join Ted Gavin for another edition of the program and some more great stories next Monday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time and 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Until we speak again, have a great week.